honored tonight to welcome our distinguished guest, Dr. Ankar Gatte. He's a chief philosophy officer and a senior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute. As the TRP faithful know, Ayn Rand was one of the greatest philosophers of all time. A comprehensive, reason-based system is focused on objective reality, liberty, individual rights, and free enterprise. Dr. Gatte is the Institute's resident expert on objectivism and serves as its senior trainer and editor. We happen to have three regular contributors to the show that are objectivists. John from Connecticut, our producer, Bob from Stony Point, our announcer, and George, the objectivist, our resident intellectual caller-in-chief. Dr. Gatte has taught philosophy for over 10 years at the Objectivist Academic Center. He will speak about one of his latest collaborations, the book, A New Textbook of Americanism. He will also answer some philosophy questions by us and later on from George, the objectivist. Dr. Gatte, welcome to TRP. I'm Frank of Queens, also known as He of the First Blood, and my partner, John of Staten Island. Welcome.
Good evening, doctor.
Hi. Thanks. Great to be here.
Oh, welcome. Glad to have you.
Can you tell us about the book and what its aims are?
Sure. So it's called A New Textbook of Americanism. The subtitle is The Politics of Ayn Rand. It was edited by Jonathan Honig. And the centerpiece of the book is an incomplete sort of pamphlet or long essay that Ayn Rand wrote in installments in 1946. And what she was trying to do is outline and explain the basic political principles, including the idea of rights, that are at the foundation and at the core of the new American system of government. And to make it accessible to the general reader, to the layman, so she's not writing for fellow academics or for political scientists or for philosophers. So it's to try to make these principles clear, understandable, accessible to every American, because they need to understand these principles, to understand their form of government, to understand how to preserve it, what parties, candidates, ideas are on the side of America, and what aren't. She wrote some installments done in the form of questions and answers. So some of the questions that she wrote answers to was, what is a right? Or what are the inalienable rights of man, to use that language from the time of the founding of America? And there's some similar questions like that. She never completed it. So the Jonathan Honig's idea was, let's, in a sense, try to complete it. So she left some questions that she thought need to be addressed, but that she never got around to addressing in further installments. And then what we know from her further writing and thinking about political philosophy, there are certain topics, for instance, about property rights, that are crucial to her whole view and her whole view of what's important, valuable, and unique about America. So there are various contributors. I'm one of the contributors to the book, took up other issues that are relevant to thinking about the founding principles of America, and particularly Ayn Rand's unique perspective on what those founding principles are and why they're so important. So there's a number of contributing authors who took sort of sections of that kind of project to try to write answers from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism.
When did she flee Russia?
So she was born in, 1905 in Russia, and she was able to get out in her early 20s. She came to America. She was able to get a visa and had no intention of ever returning to Soviet Russia. She certainly didn't tell them that. When she left, she knew she was leaving for good.
So she was the product of a Bolshevik education then, correct?
Yeah, she certainly had that element in her education. If you read, she said Her first novel, We the Living, is set in Soviet Russia at around that, I mean, the time that Ayn Rand was there. And it's a kind of first-hand account in fictionalized form. But I think you're interested in Ayn Rand's education. I think what Kira, who's the real protagonist of the novel, we see her in university and the kinds of classroom and the kind of propaganda that she's being exposed to or trying to be indoctrinated with. And I think that, I mean, very much reflects the kind of schooling at the university level that Ayn Rand herself got. At least that's my guess, and that's part of what it means to say it's the most autobiographical of the stories she's written.
So, being propagandized by the Bolsheviks, how did she formulate her ideas? Were they formulated in Bolshevik Russia, or were they formulated outside Bolshevik Russia, using Bolshevism as the opposite of what she was taught?
I think they develop. You certainly see her developing her unique ideas already in Russia, and they become further and further developed, more explicit, more defined once she reaches America and starts on the career of being a fiction writer. And you see the development of her ideas from We the Living, her first book, to The Fountainhead, her second book, her first bestseller, and Anthem, which is written around the same time as when she's working on The Fountainhead, and then Atlas Shrugged. You see a lengthy development of her ideas that blossom into a whole philosophy and philosophical system. But they're already, you can see the kernel of her approach in Soviet Russia. And part of the whole approach is the emphasis on the individual, the importance of the individual in terms of his value and that he has a right to the pursuit of happiness, to put it in the Declaration of Independence terms, and that to really pursue his happiness, he has to think for himself. And so he can't be in any way chained, as she would often put it in the early years, to a collective. Can't be chained economically to a collective, and the whole fate in it, whether he can get a job or not, is determined by the Politburo or various organizations and political, I mean, in the end, political gangs. But also you have to be free intellectually. You have to be free to think for yourself, form your own conclusions, and then pursue your own values. And that individualism you see early on in her thought, which is it's that positive value that makes her so, to find the Soviet Russia and communism, and indeed communism and fascism, which is spreading across Europe, as evil and as antithetical, as opposed to everything that is good. So that the core of the individualism is there, I think, already in Soviet Russia, and it's a whole philosophy then that gets developed when she's working in America. But one of its core ideas remains the importance of the individual, morally and sort of philosophically, that you have to think for yourself, earn your own way, and you need to be free to do so then.
Well, that's pretty astounding, given that living in Bolshevik Russia at that time, you know, I don't know if she publicly expressed those ideas, but I know she would have seen the terrors and oppression and genocide that were happening over there, because had she really publicly stated that, she would have been shipped off to a camp.
Yes. And I think she was aware of that. And you can see, again, in We the Living, you can see, so Kira, the hero, is very outspoken, but is also careful because of the authorities, and particularly the ideological authorities, who are clamping down on any kind of disagreement and dissent. So she experienced that environment firsthand, and it's part of why she had to escape, because there was no room for her in Soviet Russia. And part of writing We the Living is, I mean, one of the astounding things about the 20th century, and I think it's hard to put oneself sort of to project that this is what was going on. When she came to America, she expected that people would have some understanding of individualism and would be horrified by the so-called experiment going on in Soviet Russia. But what she found was a lot of admiration and respect for this so-called experiment of supposedly trying to build some great society. And in writing We the Living, it was justice to expose that this is perverse, that what is going on in Russia is the slow strangulation of a whole population. And one of the kind of working titles for We the Living was Airtight. And the idea there is that what's happening is a slow suffocation. And she had a great difficulty getting a publisher for We the Living. And one of the things she was told is that she does not understand Soviet Russia and that this is a great experiment going on.
Well,
of course,
you know,
it turns out that she was right.
She was, and there were, I read an excellent book, and so did our producer, John, from Connecticut, and that was The Forsaken, about American workers who believed the propaganda about Bolshevik Russia, and this was during the Depression, and they went over there. You know, they were told there was no bosses and everybody is equal. And eventually they wound up in the gulag. They found out very quickly what that system was, the so-called, oh, everybody's totally equal. They found there were 18 or 20 different levels of rationing. They came over wearing work clothes, and the people in Moscow that saw them, they thought, well, that they were dressed great compared to how they were dressed, and you know, why did you leave there? Look at, you know, you must have had it pretty good. And it comes to mind that saying that the left used during the genocide that went on over there, well, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Human beings being reduced to just broken eggs.
Yeah, that's one of the disgusting moral slogans, that, and it was definitely used at the time. And there's a sense in which everyone was equal. It's that they were equally unimportant, that your life didn't count for anything, and that the collective or the state or the proletariat, I mean, you can give it different names, but it's some entity stands above the individual. The individual is insignificant, his life, he's expendable. And in that sense, everyone was equal, but it's equal in counting for nothing.
Or as George Orwell said, in Animal Farm, some animals are more equal than others. And you know what amazes me, Doctor? That there are people that still adhere to that myth, that they somehow believe that socialism in all of its aberrant forms is the panacea. To me, it hinges on that it is a religion. That, well, it didn't work in this country, but it'll work in another country, just like, well, you know, you'll get your reward in the afterlife.
Yes, for sure there's a deep connection between communism and fascism, the various forms of complete collectivism, and the earlier religions. They are, in the end, I think, secularized religions. But there is an explanation of why, so you put it, of, well, socialism has failed, it has created destruction and death everywhere it's been implemented faithfully. And it has, but it keeps being tried and thought to have appeal for its moral undertone. I mean, if you think of the communist slogan, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, it elevates need above ability. And that, as a moral slogan, almost everybody accepts, regardless of their political positions and so on. They think it's right that need entitles you to things, and it's the people who have ability, who have produced, who have created things, they owe to the people who haven't produced, who haven't created things, but have needs. And so long as you view that as moral, and Ayn Rand called this moral viewpoint altruism, it's otherism. The needs of other people trump your life, your pursuit of happiness. All that is dispensable if someone is in need and needs your money, your time, your values, your wealth. As long as that's regarded as moral, you're going to get political systems like socialism and communism that try to implement that moral.
Well, Doctor, this is John of Staten Island. Yes, you're right, but all it is a slogan, because that's what the left always does. It hides behind slogans that sound nice, but it's really only for those at the top who want all the power and the control. So they hide behind statements like that to get people to follow them. But it never works out that way. They're the only ones that get, and everyone else suffers. We've got George, the objectivist, on the line. He wants to ask you a couple of questions. Is that all right, Doctor?
Sure, sounds good.
Hey, George, welcome.
Yes, Dr. Gatte, I have a few questions for you. Ayn Rand once said that the most evil person in the history of the world was Immanuel Kant. Now, most people think of evil historical beings as Hitler, Mao, Stalin. Could you explain to the listeners what she meant by Kant being the most evil person?
Yeah, I can try. So he's a philosopher at the end of the 18th and into the 19th centuries, a German philosopher. And she viewed him as the most evil person in recorded history, and you could think modern history, because his philosophical ideas and system put an end to the Enlightenment and made possible the rise of various forms of mysticism and irrationalism in the 19th century that then produces politically and in political philosophy systems that demand absolute power, and absolute power for the state and for the leader, and you get socialism, communism, fascism, and the destruction that that caused in the 20th century. So she certainly views Hitler and Stalin as these are enormously evil people, but she thinks they're made possible by, and all of these people are made possible by this thinker who put an end to the Enlightenment. And if you put the Enlightenment, that's like this great period in Western history where they toss aside religious faith, appeal to the supernatural, and it's a discovery or a rediscovery of reason, of science, and of the individual, that he has to choose to think for himself. But if he does, he can make something for his life, he can pursue his own happiness. Enlightenment formulates this whole doctrine of the rights of man, and Ayn Rand viewed, and I think rightly, America as the last great product of the Enlightenment. So as one of her students put it, it's the nation of the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment is this enormously positive intellectual force, and what Kant says, basically, everything that the Enlightenment thinks is wrong. So that, no, reason does not have the power to know reality. All it does is it creates its own worlds. You're sort of locked in your mind. It's called the phenomenal world in Kantian terminology. Real reality, what reality is really like, Kantian terminology, the noumenal world. Nobody can know that by using your faculties, reason. Any kind of insight into the noumenal world requires faith. And so one of the things Kant explicitly said, that he's working to deny reason in order to make room for faith. So if you think of the Enlightenment as pushing religion aside, Kant is trying to revive it by limiting and undercutting reason. And so that's one of his chief targets. And his other chief target is the idea that in morality you should pursue your own happiness, that this is corrupt, that happiness and the pursuit of it has nothing essential to do with morality. Morality is about doing your duty, of doing it because you're supposed to do it. And if you get like taking orders, and that's where the political authoritarianism comes from in the end. So two key ideas of the Enlightenment are reason is able to know reality and you should pursue your own happiness. Kant says both are wrong, and in that way, in the intellectual world, puts an end to the Enlightenment. And so her view was this was the beginning of the end. And she viewed Kant as the genius level mind. So he knew what he was doing. It's not some innocent error mistake that he made. He knew that he was undermining these enormously powerful and valuable forces, the force of reason, the idea of the pursuit of happiness.
But what was driving him to do that?
Well, if you take seriously the way he puts it, I found it necessary to deny reason in order to make room for faith. What he saw was that the Enlightenment, if it was carried to its full promise, would put an end to religion as a cultural force. I mean, it's not that there would not be any religious people, but it would have no significance or power. That's the direction in which the Enlightenment was moving. And that, I mean, he's in many ways a deeply religious person who, this is threatening the way I live my life and the way I think, and I have to put a stop to this. So in the way that there were many people opposed during the Enlightenment to the Enlightenment ideas, it comes from a real hatred of reason and of the requirement to follow reason and to think for yourself. And so, and it's, her view was, this is a person who's trying to undercut this. One of the ways, I think this is a helpful kind of way that she looked at it to get to what she thinks is the personality and the psychology here. She talked, one of the ways she thinks about this kind of mentality. You know, when you're dealing with a child and you're explaining something to them, they're trying to figure something out, and they are able to either to learn it or to achieve it, to do something, and it's like this light bulb look on their face of, oh, now I see. And a normal person's response to that is, oh, this is something great. But there is a kind of person who wants to extinguish that. And that is like was her view of Kant, that he's trying to extinguish this. And it comes from a very shriveled and ugly soul.
Let me
an article on this called The Age of Envy that about this mentality that is very interesting.
Let me ask you another thing. She was a great admirer of the philosopher Aristotle, and Aristotle was the opposite of Plato. He was the student of Plato. Could you explain to the listeners what Ayn Rand had in common with the philosophy of Aristotle, briefly?
Yes. So she saw herself as in the Aristotelian tradition. So Plato, part of his philosophy is there's two worlds or two dimensions. There's this world that you see with your eyes and can touch, the world of sense perception. It's a low, half-real, sort of chaotic, contradictory place. But there's another transcendent, supernatural dimension where nothing changes, everything is static, perfect, and your whole orientation should be to that dimension and ignore the world around you. And a lot of Christianity is modeled on and grafted on Platonism, so Plato's philosophy and his followers, and then it was called Neoplatonism. But it's like Plato's view, it should strike you, like I've heard that in religion, and you have, because particularly with Christianity, because it takes a lot from Plato. And Aristotle's perspective was, no, there is not two dimensions. We don't have to invent this kind of supernatural world. The world around us is real, it's intelligible. If we use our reason properly, we can understand it. And then he had enormous amount to say about what it means to use reason properly. He's really the discoverer and the formulator of the whole idea of logic, and logic as our method of understanding reality. And I think if you read his works, he's really the first scientist in the history of the West. And so what we were talking about in regard to the Enlightenment, he's the figure that the Enlightenment is really building upon. They don't know that fully, but it's his ideas that they're carrying further. And when you get mathematical science, it's science and math combined. You get science in the ancient world, and Aristotle is really the first systematic, self-conscious scientist. So he's the discoverer of the power of reason, that there's one reality, that we can know it if we're logical. And this, I mean, Ayn Rand agrees with all of that. This is such an enormous achievement. And I'm, like the Enlightenment, I'm building on Aristotle's foundation. So she's squarely on the side of Aristotle, completely opposed to Plato.
Now, you had mentioned that Christianity was heavily influenced by the philosophy of Plato, believing in an afterlife and another world into supernaturalism. Now, one of the criticisms about Ayn Rand is that she was an atheist, and she's completely against the tenets, a lot of the tenets of Christianity. And this is one of the reasons that people do not latch onto her or have a hard time latching onto her way of thinking, because people have been raised as Christians. Could you address that particular issue and what the problem is?
Yes, so she was an atheist. Objectivism as a philosophy is an atheistic philosophy. But one of the ways she put her atheism is, I'm an intransigent atheist. So there's no negotiating or compromising about this. I'm an intransigent atheist, but I'm not a militant one. And I think what she meant by that is she's not interested in just knocking down someone's religion or religious beliefs. She's interested in presenting a superior alternative to religion. And she thought of philosophy, and then particularly her philosophy of objectivism, as something better than religion. So what religion is striving for, which is to help you make sense of the world, to give you a world view, to help you understand, like, this is the basic nature of the world, my place in it, my nature, and so that, therefore, this is what I should do. If you think of this is part of what sort of religion is supposedly giving you guidance about, she thought, yes, you do need those kinds of views, you do need guidance about this, but in order to have proper views about all of this, you cannot go by faith. It is too important. You have to go by reason, observation, evidence, logic, and that's what a philosophy tries to do. So it presents a worldview, but it argues for its worldview, and it tries to prove its worldview. It doesn't say swallow this on faith. So she's presenting an enormously positive picture of both the world and one's place in it, that if you put in the effort to think, if you choose to think and then pursue knowledge and pursue your own happiness, you can make something great of your life. You can reach happiness. You can achieve and create meaning in your life. You have one life to live, but it can be a glorious life if you put in the work. And that's her perspective. So she viewed herself as she's presenting something better than religion. And that's the sense, I think, what she meant. She's not a militant atheist. I'm not there to sort of wag my finger at you and how stupid are you to be religious or to believe in God or something. She thought those are wrong, but it's rather, here's what's right, and this is what you should adopt. And that was her perspective. And you see that throughout her novels. They present a shining vision of what life could be.
You know, the German writer and communist Bertolt Brecht, he wrote in his Dry Groschen opera, the Threepenny Opera, there's a line in there, it's called Erst kommt das Fressen, dann kommt die Moral, which is roughly translated, one feeds one's face before we talk about morality. Now, when people are really down and out, how can they accept the morality of objectivism? For example, the caravans coming out of Central America, these people who are hungry for a better life, and they're just being attracted to America. Can we fault them, what's going on there?
Yeah, I think absolutely not. I think it's something admirable. Anybody, even in dire circumstances, can work to preserve a vision that a better life is possible. and to not be, even if they're hungry, so on, not to be immersed in these feelings of hunger and that this is all that life is about. Something more is possible. And the person who then takes action, often against enormous obstacles and odds, to want to make something of their life. I view these people, or at least most of them, who are coming, like the immigrants in the 19th century, that they thought of America as, it's a place where I can be free and I can make something of myself. And even if I come from the lowest of circumstances, it, because it respects me as an individual and says I have the same rights as any other individual, it's a place of an enormous promise and possibility. And one can maintain that vision even in difficult circumstances. I mean, to go back to the issue of Ayn Rand and Soviet Russia, this is one thing she said about the whole idea, and this is in We the Living, of the notion of abroad, and then, so, of a place outside of Russia. Abroad meant, like, anywhere but Russia, and then particularly of America. It's that concrete vision of, even though I'm hungry or close to starving, that something better is possible in life. It's important to preserve that, and you can preserve that. I mean, people preserved it in concentration camps. So it's a very difficult achievement to do it, but it is possible, I think, and it is important to work to do so, because life can be something great.
What about the building of the wall that President Trump is advocating? Does the Ayn Rand Institute agree with that?
No, but the essence of the issue, I think, and a wall on the southern border, is that it's somehow a threat that people who want to come and work, so leave aside the issue of terrorists. I mean, that is a real issue. I don't think a wall on the southern border fixes it. And if you think of 9/11, say, and the terrorists there, a wall on the southern border is not the solution. So there is a real issue about terrorism from the Middle East that needs to be addressed. So that is a real issue. But the wall, I think, is a smokescreen about dealing with that issue. So it's,
well, I want to ask you a question. Why does the Ayn Rand Institute staunchly support Israel, which is building a wall around Gaza, and by extension, Jewish monotheism? If she believes in atheism, why would the Institute staunchly support Israel, and by extension, Jewish monotheism?
Yeah, I don't think it's an issue of supporting Jewish monotheism. So there's support for Israel despite its religious overtones, not because of them. And we have if people are really interested in this issue, a colleague of mine, Alain Durnow, has a recent book out, What Justice Demands, and it's about Israel and Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So you can read much more about that. But we support Israel because it's the one free country in the Middle East. It's the one, you could think of it as an outpost of Western civilization in the Middle East. And in the same way that we should support free countries in other places, whether it's Taiwan in Asia or countries like the UK, you support them because of their political system. And the same is true of Israel. So it's not, we don't support it because it has, there's religious encroachment on government. That's a problem, and a significant problem in Israel. You support it because it's a rights-respecting country. And then if you think of the whole Middle East, that it's populated by dictatorships and worse, so theocracies or wannabe theocracies, who have a whole ideology that is anti-West and anti-America in particular, the idea that you wouldn't support a country that opposes that, I think, does not make any sense. So we're very critical of American support for Saudi Arabia, because these are actually enemy countries, and they're countries that spread an ideology that true. It's the opposite in regard to Israel.
Now, in 52 years since the publication of Rand's seminal work, Atlas Shrugged, which has influenced millions, why are millennials like Cortez elected promising Medicare for all?
Well, you might say because not enough people have read and taken seriously Atlas Shrugged. And you can expand on that, because in a sense, I was being a little facetious, but that's true. What Atlas Shrugged is challenging is this whole morality of altruism and of self-sacrifice, that what the good is about giving up your values for the sake of people who don't have values and who are just the mere fact that they're in need. And you don't ask any question about why are they in need? Why haven't they made something of their lives? Are they victims of injustice? Or they just couldn't be bothered to earn a living? And so you can't ask any questions like that. You just point out that someone's in need, and then what you have to, as it will be put, give back. You haven't taken anything from them, but you have to give back. You have to sacrifice and surrender your values to people in need. And so long as that view, which is ultimately in the West, I mean, a major element of this view comes from religion. I mean, this is what Jesus is preaching on the Sermon on the Mount. As long as you take that, as that's what the moral viewpoint is, particularly for young people who think of themselves as, I want to be idealistic. I want to have ideals and try to live up to them and so on. This is the moral ideal that they're supposed to have and to try to live up to. And so long as that's what is taught, you're going to get the people who think of themselves as more idealistic preaching this and preaching it in one form or another. And I think what you're seeing on college campuses today with the millennials and others is this. Like, if we're taking seriously morality, isn't this what we should be doing? And isn't it something like universal health care and socialism? And so, and we know that profits and money and millionaires and billionaires, they're all bad, corrupt, selfish. And if as long as that is viewed sort of as not even questionable whether that view is right or not, just to question it, you're branded as, well, there's something wrong with you if you think that making money and being selfish, and Ayn Rand wrote a whole book, The Virtue of Selfishness. If you're damning that, and it's not even debatable, you can't expect anything else than young people turning in one way or another to these kinds of ideas.
Well, their morality amounts to thinking that it's right to steal other people's money and give it away to someone else. Our friendly neighborhood announcer, Bob, has a question. Get his input here. Doctor, he says, hi, John and Frank. Make mention to your guest about New York Times Russian correspondent Walter Duranty promulgating the myth about the Soviet Union at the time. S.J. Taylor's book, Stalin's Apologist, is a testament of that time in Russian history.
Yes, sir. I mean, there were many apologists. Duranty was one for Soviet Russia. And it's, again, I think you can't understand that there were so many apologists unless you get that the reason it was thought as a great and noble experiment is because it was thought of as they're taking seriously and trying to implement a moral slogan. So the moral ideal, again, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. So long as that is viewed as moral, then yeah, isn't this a great experiment? Like, isn't this what we should be trying to implement? And maybe it hasn't worked here, maybe it hasn't worked there, but shouldn't we keep trying? Because if we want to be crusaders for what is moral, shouldn't we be doing this? And what you had at the foundation of America is a different moral picture. So the idea of that morality is about the pursuit of your own happiness, so diametrically opposed to from each according to his ability to each according to his need. And if you get that kind of moral shift, you're going to get all kinds of people who are saying things like Soviet Russia. And I mean, the same was true in various ways for fascism early on. These are great experiments.
Can I ask, today's New York Times on the front page referred to the Supreme Court not overturning a law that Louisiana had about the abortion doctors having to have admission rights to nearby hospitals, and so they left the abortion viable in the state of Louisiana for the time being. Could you address, please, Ayn Rand's view on abortion? Now, I'm looking at the Ayn Rand lexicon here, and it says here she wrote, "An embryo has no right. The rights do not pertain to a potential, only to an actual being." So since abortion is on the front burner of society today, could you explain what she meant by that? Now, she also said, it says, "One may argue about the later terms of a pregnancy, but the essential issue concerns only the first 3 months." Could you explain a little bit more about what she's getting at here?
Yes. So I think part of the way she's viewing this whole issue is this is the encroachment of a religious view on the proper principles of the American system. And she thought the American system does separate church and state, and that was an important achievement of the whole American system. So that the idea of rights is the idea that for an individual, but that so presupposes that you have an existing individual, for him or for her to benefit from being in society. So to be able to reap the rewards of human society, and there's all kinds of rewards from learning from others, working with others, the whole division of labor, from having friends, lovers. So there's enormous benefits to be gained from human interaction and organized human society. But in order to be able to get the benefits and avoid all the harms that are possible, I mean, people can beat you up, rob you, kill you, to get the benefits, avoid the harms, the whole social organization, so the social political system, has to be founded on and organized by the principle of individual rights. But it applies to an existing individual who's capable of independent choice, independent action, independent reasoning. So an individual has a right to life, to liberty, which means freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of association, a right to earn property, and a right to pursue his own happiness. When we're talking about a fetus, so an early, certainly, I think her view was, this is true of all stages of pregnancy, it's more arguable for later, though I don't think she thinks it changes the argument, but certainly when you think, as you put it, for the first 3 months, you do not have an independent, individual, existing human being. You have a potential, something that will, over time, if it's carried to term, develop, develop into an existing individual, but it's still a potential. And a potential doesn't have rights. The whole idea of rights and the principle of rights doesn't apply when you're still talking about a potential. And she thought it's an enormous violation of the rights of the woman and of the parents if you were to force her to bring the fetus to term. It is part of the right to life, the right to liberty, the right to think for yourself, the right to pursue your own happiness, is you have to be able to make this choice and make this decision. That is, you have to be free to do it. So she was an enormous defender of the right to abortion. She viewed it as it's part of a woman's right to life and to the pursuit of happiness to be able to make this decision. And she did not view it as sort of there's two competing rights, the rights of the women and the rights of the fetus. The fetus is a potential. The whole issue and principle of rights does not apply to the fetus in the way you would say it applies to a child. They belong in different categories, and you have to think differently about it.
But she said one may argue about the later stages of pregnancy. That's what we are all arguing about right now, late-term abortion. So what is an objectivist to do? Are there conflicting views that objectivists have?
There probably are some objectivists who have different views on this. So the way I read her whole discussion there is that one may argue, it's that one can understand the argument or some of it in terms of the later stages of pregnancy. But I don't think the issue of abortion actually is about the late stages of pregnancy. All the major forces in the culture that talk about the late stage and that's what we're want to stop and so on, their actual view and position is they want to outlaw abortion as such, and that is the issue that she's addressing.
On the other hand, now, I was listening to a recording that the New Ideal sent me, which is one of your programs that your institute puts out, and it was on objective law. And she mentioned in there that she was essentially philosophically pro-capital punishment. But she said, again, the argument could be made very strongly not to have capital punishment because an innocent person could be put to death. So there is contention sometimes amongst objectivists and Ayn Rand herself with abortion and capital punishment.
Well, I don't think there is really about abortion. I think capital punishment is different. So what she said about it is, from a moral perspective, capital punishment is warranted. When you think of someone murdering someone in cold blood, so premeditated murder, capital punishment is appropriate. But when she's talking about, so from a moral perspective, but when you're talking about law, you're talking about a whole system of legal principles that you create institutions that are then charged with implementing these principles, carrying them out in a deliberate, rational way that it is open to the whole citizenry to understand, okay, this is what's happening, this is why, these are the standards of evidence, these are the standards of proof. It has to all be systematically defined and codified. And what she wondered is, could you codify it in such a way that you will have, for the case of capital punishment, where there's no recourse if you get it wrong, can you get standards in law and the whole then application of those standards such that you're confident that when its decision is, yeah, capital punishment in this case is warranted, we're putting this person to death, you're certain that that's the right judgment. And she wondered about, like, can you define this into law and define the standards of proof, of evidence and proof in such a way that you can be confident of that? And she wasn't sure about that. So her view wasn't, it's impossible to do this, but you better be damn sure you've done it before you put a man to death.
All right, George.
George, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and Dr. Gatte, want to thank you for coming on The Right Perspective. We hope you'll come on again. Could you please give the title of your new book and where it can be purchased?
Yes, so it's a new textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand, edited by Jonathan Honig. You can find it, as you can find most books, on Amazon. Search for a new textbook of Americanism or Jonathan Honig, last name Honig, and you can find it there. And it contains some writings by Ayn Rand that are very interesting, and then some by other objectivist scholars, including myself. And thanks for having me on the program. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I want to ask you, is that the same Jonathan Honig who used to be on the program at the movies when he was a kid? Does he have a website, Capitalist Pig?
Yes. Right.
Okay, I know who he is. Just let me leave you with this, and we do hope you'll come back. The only three things that Bolshevism ever produced were slogans, parades, and propaganda. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, good night. Take care.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.